The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
I've been involved over the past number of years in, I would say, picking up the pieces in Jewish education. You know, people that can't get jobs as machanchim and rebbeim become janitors. You know, they pick up the pieces. Well, I've been picking up pieces, not necessarily trash, in fact, not at all trash, but rather korbonos, kids who've gone through the yeshiva system and for one reason or another just didn't make it. But they didn't just not make it. They didn't make it. They really, you know, they came out with failure branded all over them, completely diminished self-image and self-worth, anger that's seething within, running the other direction from anything that has to do with Yiddishkeit, and of course getting involved with the alternatives and the substitutes that our society provides for these kids, which are dismal and scary and downright dangerous. And in the process, I guess I've learned a thing or two. And part of what I've learned is that we're not necessarily facing and focused on a Yiddishkeit that's really appreciated for what it is. A lot of people going through the yeshiva world and the yeshiva system and more high school, you know, junior high school, some when they get into yeshiva, sometimes they get to put it together if they stick around for a year or two after high school. But certainly in a high school age, they find a lot of things they don't understand, questions they have that weren't answered, apparent inconsistencies which trouble them, and many things that I guess in the most common cliche, turn them off. And what I found is that if we analyze some of these things and address them from a more, I guess, appropriate, you know, I don't mean to say, but a more relevant Torah perspective, what we find is that these kids really shouldn't have been turned off in the first place, and they can be awakened and brought back and turned around, turned on to Yiddishkeit. And therefore, when I get an opportunity to speak to adults, to, you know, people, family people, from people who've established themselves in their lives already or certainly in the process, I like to take advantage of some of these lessons and present, share them with others, hopefully inspiring and maybe helping people in their quest for a more meaningful existence, and certainly in their desire to impart more meaning and understanding in the lives of their children. And I guess that's what this is about from one perspective. The other perspective is, I think we gave a title to this session, which really is just an outgrowth of the first concept, and that is finding happiness through appreciation of mitzvahs. Because one of the saddest things that I find, and I guess it's only more exaggerated in these kids, but it's really in everybody, or most of us, that people don't really appreciate the mitzvahs that they perform, and they don't really find the kind of happiness that they need. And everybody, in case you weren't aware of it, everybody needs to be happy, and everybody wants to be happy. And even though sometimes we think or we call other experiences with as substitutes for happiness, but deep down we know pleasure doesn't substitute for happiness, and money doesn't substitute for happiness, and COVID and fame doesn't substitute for happiness. Happiness is something that's very inside, in me, internal. It has to be happiness and happiness with myself as I am. And it's almost like any happiness that's dependent upon other things can't really make me permanently happy, because first of all, you don't know how much longer these other things are going to be available, and secondly, it's not me. It's an experience rather than a feeling. It's a thrill rather than an identity. So we want to be happy means we want to feel good about ourselves. I think to be happy, we have to know a little bit about what makes the human being tick. Now, certainly, I'm not more human than anybody here, therefore maybe I have no right to talk about what makes human being tick. I think I'm a little older than everybody here, maybe even then two, not three together, that much I wouldn't go, but then any two together, and therefore maybe a little bit experience, but what's the human being all about? The Vilna Gaon has a famous but beautiful moshel about what a human being is about. He says, a human being is compared to a horse and a rider. The horse is an animal. Wants freedom, wants fun, wants association with other horses or other specific types of horses. He wants to have a blast. I mean, this is really the horses. He'll run free and he likes to eat and he likes to do what he likes to do and go where he likes to go and be free from responsibility and burden. There's a rider. The rider on the horse has a sense of purpose, wants to go someplace, unless he's just riding for pleasure, but normally he has a direction, has a sense of goal, mission, purpose, meaning, he knows what it's all about. And he wants to guide, or use, is a better word, the horse, to get where he has to go, to accomplish what he has to accomplish, and to feel good about it, and to be happy. And oftentimes, there's a conflict, because the horse is pulling in one direction. And if the rider is not sharp enough, skilled enough, clear enough in where he has to go and in how to get there and how to manipulate or manage or control or direct that horse in order to get there, he may end up in the wrong place and whatever the consequences or the price he has to pay. This is really what we're about. We're about body and soul. In body, we're very similar to animals. In fact, on a certain level, we can understand those who would peg us as descendants of monkeys, and that's oversimplifying the scientific theory, but, because we have an awful lot in common with the monkeys. On the other hand, we have something that no animal has. We have this soul. We have a spiritual component in our existence. And that spiritual component is very familiar to all of us, even if we don't think about it all the time, because we know that we appreciate a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. We know that we have goals that we feel happy if we achieve. We know that we have conscience. When we do something right, we feel good. When we do something wrong, we feel guilty. And we know that we crave for things more than just the physical pleasures that would satisfy the animal kingdom. And yet, there's that conflict. The body, just like the horse, pulls in its direction and wants to be satisfied, wants to be pleased, and wants to enjoy, and wants to have fun, and wants to fulfill its desires and be full of pleasure. The soul, on the other hand, wants to lead it. Have a purpose. There's meaning, there's purpose. There's values, there's right and wrong. There's fulfillment, there's accomplishment. There's an eternity that I want to leave a mark on. And that craving for eternity, by the way, is a product of the soul. You know, when you see people's names up on buildings, or plaques that were used to be always made of bronze, that's because people really are craving eternity and hoping that the plaque will even outlive them. Not even when they won't be here, but that plaque, even if the building burns down, but that plaque, will be there because we want, we crave, we don't know how to find it all the time, but we crave that eternity. Those are soul things. Those are part of that spiritual part of us. And the human being is that combination of spirit and goof, body and soul. And this conflict, sometimes the body wants to do certain things, and the soul knows that, the director knows that it's not the right way to go. Sometimes the director wins the battle, and sometimes the body carries the day. But it's that conflict that eventually leads, hopefully, the soul to master that body and to lead it in the right direction, much as the horse, much as the rider will lead that horse, and we, you know, we win the race, we win the battle, we, you know, we come home safely. That's really what we're all about. That being the case, it's very important to address the needs of both components. Because if you just feed the horse and the rider starves, eventually he's going to die. If you just feed the rider and the horse is, hungered, the rider's not going to be able to get any place. And it's finding that right combination of nurturing both that really provides for human happiness. In the history of religion, which I don't know too much about, but on a superficial level, Eastern religions have put a great emphasis on the soul. They negate the body. They talk about asceticism, fasting, and the body is meaningless, and everything is spiritual, the whole world is spiritual, and there's spiritual energies, and this and that and the other thing. And it doesn't really work, because, you know, the human being, the soul is housed in a body. Now, if you don't take care of the house, it's going to collapse. So you can't get away with that. Western civilization has done just the opposite. Western civilization has basically taken the position since Darwin that there is no such thing as a soul. It's only the body. It's only pleasure. It's only fulfillment. It's not moral imperative. It's not responsibility. It's not it's not purpose and meaning in life. It's just having a good time and fun. In fact, I dare say, it's my own theory, but I think it's, you know, there's quite a good basis for it, that that's the reason that the world has embraced Darwin and his theory of evolution with such a passion. On a scientific level, I'm not the expert, but from what I read and what I know from scientific people, that it's so unlikely and statistically invalid and irrational and so full of contradictions in terms of the missing links and the whole system and so forth, that it really doesn't make any sense. But the world has continued to embrace that theory because it's that theory that has freed us from the shackle of responsibility and burden. Because if, and again to oversimplify, man is a product of an accident, to accident there's no purpose. If there's no purpose, do what you want. Have a good time. You're not here for a purpose, so you're not going to miss the boat if you don't find that purpose. You can enjoy your life, you know, have a good time, party all day long, and after everything is said and done, there is nothing else, because all we are is a bunch of accidents. And that's why the world looked for this. But the sad reality is that the world is miserable today. I don't know what businesses or professions you people are in, but if the business is getting a little rough, you should go back to school and study to be a shrink. They're busy all day and all night. They really, psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, social workers, anything. Just have some kind of a degree with something to do. Say it has to do with psychology. You can even hang up a shingle and say you're a psychotherapist, even if you're just a plumber. There's no law against it in New York State. It's like, why? Because people are not happy. We live in a society. Look at it. It's so strange. Never so many pleasures accessible to so many people with such intensity. Never so much freedom. Never so much wealth to be able to do and go and see and experience everything that we want to experience. And never a society that's been so freed from the shackles of religion. We're not just talking about Judaism, but just since, you know, the last 150 years, since Darwin, 130 years, whatever. First time in human history where a large bulk of society does not feel obligated to the directives of a creator because they're here by accident. And yet, happiness is not to be found. It's so rare to find a person who's happy. there was a Viennese psychiatrist. His name was Viktor Frankl. He lived in Vienna till just a couple of years ago. And he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in this book, he reviews 50 years of practicing psychiatry after the Holocaust in Vienna. He was a Holocaust survivor. And he says that he has found that the underlying problem in the vast majority of the patients that he has treated over this long career has to do with a sense of a lack of purpose in life. People crave purpose. See, the body doesn't crave purpose. The monkeys don't crave purpose. Our pets don't crave purpose. But human beings who are made of body and soul, the soul part of us, the neshama part of us, the spiritual part of us, craves meaning and purpose. And without that sense of purpose, what am I here for? Oh, I'm here by accident. If I'm here by accident, then I can't take it. Right? That's the stuff that mental breakdowns are made of, because what am I getting up in the morning for? Oh, gonna play with the accident. What's it all about? It's just like, it doesn't add up. And this is why, and we see so much mental illness today, and so much lack of fulfillment and happiness, so many drinking problems and drug problems and even legal problems. It all has to do with people craving and searching and trying, but not being happy, not with their lives, not with their fate, and not with themselves. This is really, you know, what the problem seems to be. Yadus, Judaism, takes a very different take on all of this. To my knowledge, it's the only religion that has such a sophisticated combination of the physical and the spiritual addressing the totality of the human being. I'm not saying what the purpose or God's purpose, but with a benefit of making that entire human being feel good, because it deals with all of the issues. We have a vast spiritual complex of purpose, meaning, directives, responsibilities, yet practically all of them express themselves with physical props. Shabbos is the apex of the whole week, and spiritually most uplifting and connecting with the Creator and so forth and so on. And yet it's experienced at a table like this with stuff like that and this and who knows what else, and not to forget the Shalom. And it's like it's the combination of the physical and the spiritual which allows a person to find happiness. Because happiness can't be found if part of me, just as satiation couldn't be found if I fed part of my body and the other part was hungered, if I had some way of separating the body, you know, putting some kind of a mechitza inside, and the food only goes to one part and not to the other, I couldn't live. I'd die. It wouldn't be half the body would live. Eventually you'd die. Same thing. If the spirit is not satiated, it's going to frustrate the body. It's frustrate the total human being. If the body is not satisfied, it's also not going to survive. And we find our mitzvahs and our yomim tovim, and even the tefillin and the tzitzis and the mezuzah, they're all mitzvahs that are done with physical props. We take the physical world in which we live and we transform it into a spiritual system, dealing, living in the spirit. We work. People work for a living today. Nobody paskins like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, the Torosim and Nosim that just sit in the cave, sit and learn, and the Parnosa will come in Hashemayim. Har be'osu came v'lo also be'odim, the Gemara says. Today we paskin like Reb Yishmoel. Masafta the Gonecho, person goes out to work. He goes out to work, yet he has to know that everything I do is just because that's my obligation to live with the Teva. But I have to know that the Rebbeinu Shalom is the Peseach Es Yodecho Umasbia Lechol Chai Rotzim. He does it, Ki'ilu Chazal say, it's as if he signs the checks. I work, I have my obligation, I do my Hishtadlus. But it's the combination of the physical and the spiritual, so the human being at the end of the day, having accessed and exercised his body and exercise too, and access and exercise his soul, comes together as that one totally fulfilled, accomplished, meaningful, purposeful, living, happy human being. And that's really what we're looking for. Happiness is the name of the game, and that's where we will find it, in that combination of physical and spiritual. Now, this something else about the spiritual world, which is extremely important. And this is really, I think, the key to the difference between us and the Umo Yisro'olam. Maybe two stories, which I don't know if they ever happened. They could have, but the point, I think, is well taken, even if it's just a story. A guy decided, you know, his wife, wonderful person, she works so hard, does so much for him, he's going to buy her a diamond to end all diamonds. And he, you know, comes home one day with the Queen's diamond, you know, like, not from Queens, this is Brooklyn, I know, but, you know, from the Queen of England. This is a diamond. His wife, Nichaich, wow, this is a husband. You know what I mean? Everything is great. She's walking around with this diamond for weeks and shoving it in the face of everybody she could see, you know, to show off how beautiful, how perfect, how whatever it is. One day, a friend of her husband comes to the house for dinner, and he happens to be a diamond dealer, a maven. And of course, together with the soup, comes the diamond right in his face. And he says, let me see that. That's beautiful. Takes home, pulls out. I never saw something like this. This is amazing. And then he says to her, this is the most perfect piece of cubic zirconia that I ever saw in my life. She faints. They try to revive her. She's screaming. She faints again. They revive her again. She screams, my diamond, what's going to be with my diamond? So he bends over to her body lying on the floor and says, lady, you know, don't worry. It's not so terrible. You just got to be careful. Never show it up front, you know, up close to a guy like me. And otherwise, no one will ever know that it's not real. She says, but it's not real. It's not real. He says, lady, what are you, a philosopher? It makes a difference whether it's real. It looks like a diamond. Everybody will think it's a diamond. Poor guy, forget about him. But she was never happy again. Now, diamonds are not spiritual, but they have a certain quality beyond just what they seem to be. I don't know exactly how that's measured, but in perfectness and in shape and in who knows what else. And if it isn't real, I don't advise anyone to try it. You know what I mean? It's not going to work. I'll tell you another little story about a guy who met a woman. She was an heiress to fortunes of money. And he decided that he's going to take the shortcut, the easy way, and he's going to marry this woman for her money. And whatever he's doing, courting her, eventually at some point in this relationship, her brother finds out that this is going on. This guy's only interested in his sister for her money. So he gets a hold of the guy and he holds him by the gorgo and says, get out of here, and if you ever set foot in my house, you know, break every bone in your body. And the guy says, wait a minute. He says, I'm an actor, very good one. He says, your sister will never know that I married her for her money. She'll be happy her whole life. She'll never catch on. I'm a good actor. Kids, I don't know how he convinced the brother. The brother looked the other way. They got married. 50 years of marital bliss. He wined her and dined her. Oh, I'm sure it was all with her credit cards, but it didn't matter. But this is a match made in heaven. This woman was the happiest woman in the world. When he's already been married for many years, more than 50 years, and he's getting sick, he's in the hospital, he's close to the end. So he calls her in, he says, I gotta tell you something. I only married you for your money. I never loved you a day in my life. He said, I just want you to know every nice thing I ever said was a lie. You know, goes through the whole thing. She's shattered, of course, by this whole thing. He dies shortly after. Now, 3 months later, she dies. Okay, so that was the good news. I have a question. And usually, if I ask this question to a group of single people, I tell them that be careful with your answer, because there's a very serious consequence for the wrong answer. And the question is, what would your evaluation of this situation be? Would you say that this woman had 50 great years by the time she died and 3 months of misery? Or would you say that since the last 3 months she found out that the whole 50 years was a lie, she died at Zebrochen a mensch who felt that she never had a good day in her life? And be careful, because there is a consequence. Now, what do you say? Mayor, what do you say? You know the right answer. You heard this before. Okay. So you're not so sure?
I'm sure.
You're sure? Okay. Anyway, now, to those people who give what I consider the wrong answer, and that is that she had 50 years of marital bliss and only a couple months of misery, because when she didn't know about it, the whole time she didn't know that everything was fine, I say, I got a shidduch for you, you know? For 50 years, you won't know that it wasn't real. And only at the end, you'll find out. Never did anyone take me up on that shidduch. Now, relationships are also not completely spiritual, but they're more spiritual than just physical things. There's a certain element of, they access some of the same energies that spirituality accesses. And if it isn't real, it doesn't work. See, ice cream, if it looks like ice cream, it tastes like ice cream, it costs like ice cream, and makes you fat like ice cream, makes no difference what it's made of. Not so diamonds, and not so relationships. Allah has come over, come over spirituality. Imagine I spend my whole life pursuing spiritual heights, and finally I get upstairs and there's a big sign waiting for me. It's all a hoax. We got to be sure that it's right. So what we need is two things. We need a system of living that deals with both body and soul, that's good for the body and good for the soul, which can then make us not just full with pleasure, but with happiness. And we need a system that we can be confident that the spiritual component, the physical component, makes no difference. Food can be real or artificial, as long as the taste and the nourishment and whatever. But as long as the spiritual component is true, is real. That's a tall order. That's a tall order. We want a religion that combines the spiritual and the physical. We want a religion that we can be confident that the spiritual component and directives and responsibilities and meaning and purpose is for real. Well, the good news is, I think we found such a religion. The sad news is not everybody appreciates the fact that we have such a religion. And that's really what I would like to touch on a little bit this evening, and if we have the good fortune of meeting again, maybe to continue and to expand upon it. Judaism is very different from all the religions on this planet. Now, the major religions have copied many things from us, as you're certainly aware of. Christianity, Islam, I mean, each one has taken many things. But there's one thing that they never took from Judaism. Very strange. They never co-opted the claim that the Creator himself performed the greatest of miracles publicly in front of millions of witnesses in Egypt, Mitzrayim, took this people, you know, all of them out, did further miracles for them, brought them to this place called Sinai, and publicly spoke to them in front of millions of witnesses, spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, that's what the Pasuk says, so that all of them could hear and know that Moshe Rabbeinu has been authorized publicly in front of the whole nation to be the spokesman for Hashem. and speak to them directly so that they know and that they hear and that they experience the divine communication rather than just hearing it from somebody secondhand, thirdhand, and just hearsay. Now, that's a very powerful claim, because when I claim that we all experience something, it says a lot, because had you not experienced it, had we not experienced it, we would say, hey, absolutely not. When I claim that I experienced something, maybe yeah, maybe no. You know, it's like the famous story about the Chassidish Rebbe that passed away, and he left two sons. Big argument going on, who's going to take over for him. And finally, one son comes into shul, he gives a clap on the bima, he says, everything is resolved. He says, Father appeared to me in a dream, and he said, I should be the Rebbe. And his brother looks at him and says, Yankel, if Father wanted you to be the Rebbe, he should have appeared to me in the dream. You could say whatever you want, you had a dream. But when I saw it, when the claim is that we witnessed it, that's a whole different level. Now the question is, why don't other religions make this claim? The fact is that there are five religions that make a claim of public miracles and public revelation in front of the entire nation, millions of people by their account. That claim is made, of course, by Judaism, by Islam, by Christianity, by Sikhism, and Baha'i. And yet, every one of them says that these events took place to the Jewish people at Sinai. Even Christianity and Islam, who would like to start their own religion, and they did. They piggybacked on Sinai, and then they said God found, you know, the Jewish people found disfavor in his eyes, and now he started a new religion. That new religion, by the way, was started in private. Muhammad had a dream in the middle of the night. Jesus had something else. I don't know what kind of problems he had, but a lot of different problems. But nobody ever came with this claim that public, except for Judaism. Why? I think the answer is quite obvious. It's a hard claim to make unless it's true. It's really hard to claim that millions of people witnessed events and to take those events and to write them down and to tell those people to take the documents that record these events that they themselves witnessed and the document that says that they witnessed it and pass it on to their children and their grandchildren and throughout the generations unless in fact these events took place. But Chazal weren't satisfied with this either. Chazal said, it's a Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara is talking about all kinds of simonim of animals, kosher animals and not kosher animals. And then the Gemara says, Otu Meshra Abeinu Kenigi Hoyo Iblisteri Hoyo? Was Meshra Abeinu an archer or a hunter, a zoologist? I don't know what. Mikan Zok the Gemara Tshuvo Lo'oimer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. From here is a tshuva to anyone who would say Torah is not min HaShemayim. And it's interesting, Chazal didn't say this is how you know Torah is min HaShemayim. We know Torah min HaShemayim because the Borei Olam revealed himself publicly to masses of our people, the entire nation. And those events were recorded in a Torah that says that these people actually witnessed these events. And they all took that Torah and passed it on to their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. And to this very day, thousands of years later, we all have exactly the same document with no shinui, whether the Jews were in Tayman, or whether they were in China, or whether they were in California or in Brooklyn. It's all the same. And so that's how we know Torah is min HaShemayim. But to anyone who still has a little question about is it for real, how does the Torah know information that no other human being could have known? And this refers to all of the things about the animals. This refers to all the things about the future prophecies. This refers to scientific information that the Torah knows. That's mind-boggling. We don't have the time now to go into all these things, but this is, I'm sure you people are familiar with this. So we have a system that we can validate its truth. If we know that it's true, so then the other part of it is to sense its meaning, to sense its purpose, to feel, to connect, to internalize, to find excitement in the fulfillment of that purpose. And then we begin to feel that spiritual uplift and that combination of physical and spiritual to make us humanly and totally happy. And for that, I'd like to refer you, and I think this is a major text in this field that should be studied regularly, and that's the Sefer HaChinuch. I'd like to refer you to a comment that the Sefer HaChinuch was written, and he says so in the Hakdoman, he says so in a number of different places, was written as a gift is bar mitzvah bochur. I don't know if anybody here is planning a bar mitzvah in the near future, but maybe you should consider writing a book for your kid. But not just a book. He wrote him a book that explained, by his own words, the benefits and the reasons behind all the mitzvahs. Gave him each one of the mitzvahs, told him what it was about, and gave him a tam v'toelis, he calls it. A tam, a reason, and toelis, and a benefit. This is what he did on Tariag mitzvahs. He comes to one mitzvah, and he has a problem. Mitzvah of not bringing sor and vash on the mizbeach. No leaven and no honey should be brought on the mizbeach. He's not sure what the reason is. He's confused. And he says he considered not writing about this mitzvah at all. But then he says he's afraid of the repercussions if he doesn't write about it. And he says he's afraid that his children, his son, and his friends, if they don't understand tam v'toelis, reason and benefit in this one mitzvah, he's afraid that they will find the Torah to be as a closed book. They won't appreciate it. It won't make them fulfilled, happy. And he says, "Pen yivatu bohem mitoichkach ben arusom v'yanichum lo'olam v'yelchu lahevel." And that's a quote. He's afraid they will rebel against all of the mitzvahs in their youth and forsake them forever and join up with their folly, with the foolishness of the world. Beinishalei. He is a man, he lived 500 years ago at least, we don't know exactly who he is, but he was from the Tkufa of the Rishonim. 500 years ago in a world that was, I guess, relatively normal compared to our society today. He already wrote 612 reasons and benefits for all the mitzvahs. There's one that he's not so sure of. This particular one is not Nagel HaMaisa because it has to do with the Beis HaMikdash, which means his kid is not going to be in the Beis HaMikdash wondering why in the world am I doing this stupid thing. It's not going to be. It's just a theoretical thing. Shebone Beis HaMikdash. Yet he's afraid if he doesn't give benefit, reason, Tam also means, I saw once from Rabbi Gifter, a Geschmack. The reason is something, it makes the mitzvah more, you can appreciate it more. I'm doing something, I understand what I'm doing, it's more meaningful to me. I feel the union that I'm doing. And benefit, if he doesn't tell his kid the reason and the benefit for one mitzvah, he's afraid he's going to rebel against all the mitzvahs and forsake them, not go off the derech for a couple of years and then come back. V'yanichum le'oilom v'yelchu la'hevel. It seems that it's so important. Certainly at the initial encounter with the mitzvahs, at the youngest stages in life when we first begin to have an appreciation for these mitzvahs. In order for the mitzvahs to be spiritually fulfilling for us, we have to know, and the Sefer Achinuch doesn't say, no, his son knows that it's true. That's not his problem. Because to know that it's true, just tell him, look, these are the mitzvahs, says in the Torah, I'll prove to you the Torah is from Hashem, millions of witnesses, information, this, that, the other thing, it's clear. But he won't appreciate one mitzvah. He might rebel against the whole system. Not for sure, but it could happen. All because there's one mitzvah that he doesn't appreciate. Tam v'toelis. So I think it's very important for us in teaching our children that we can communicate to them the benefit of the mitzvahs. But I imagine that for us to be able to communicate benefit of mitzvahs, we have to have a deeper sense of the benefit than these mitzvahs ourselves. And this is really what I think is a very worthwhile endeavor, you know, to learn. Because I think if people today will spend time with a text like the Sefer Achinuch or the likes of that, delving into the reasons and benefits of the mitzvahs, then the Torah will not, in the words of the Sefer Achinuch, seem to be a Sefer Chosum, like it's closed, like it's hidden. We'll feel comfortable with it. We'll feel the fulfillment of our purpose in life, and we'll sense the nature of not only that global purpose, but the specific purposes for each and every one of the acts that we perform. It gives us a whole sense of accomplishment, of meaning, of fulfillment, of happiness. Combined with the fact that these acts and these mitzvahs deal very directly with the physical world, we find ourselves living a life of happiness, feeling that we have meaning and purpose, feeling that we're fulfilling that purpose in life, and truly being able to find a sense of true and total happiness. There's many examples that we could start with, and I think the hour is late. But if you'll just permit me to take a bizarre example, or a bizarre system of examples, and maybe that'll be just, you know, a point at which to depart and hopefully proceed to a deeper, more intensive study of some of these, the benefits of these mitzvahs. There's two Jewish practices which I believe are related. One is a love of loisachroi shoyer v'chamoyer yachtov, not permitted to plow under one yoke locked together with an ox and a donkey. It's a love in the Torah. Can't do it. And another is a din minig derabonon, that when you make kiddush on wine, it's supposed to cover the chalas. One thing has to do with another. Well, Chazal say that the reason for the covering of the chalas is shelo yire hapas boishtoi. The bread shouldn't witness its embarrassment at your taking the wine first. I'd like to touch just on these two, one mitzvah, one hanhoga, and maybe see a benefit that leaps out at us from this performance. The Sefer HaChinuch explains that the reason for the love of not plowing under the same burden, under the same yoke with an ox and a donkey together, is because he says species are most comfortable with their own. You see, you travel in the mountainside, you see the cows with the cows, and the horses with the horses, and the sheep with the sheep, and the birds with the birds, and the certain people, you know, we're comfortable with our own. So he says that the shor and the chamor are going to feel a certain, he doesn't use the word, but I guess instinctive discomfort. It's an instinct. They don't have the heart and the mind as we know it, I mean, as far as we know. But a certain instinctive discomfort in being tied together like that. And the Torah forbids us to do it because of that. Now, it's quite obvious, and I think he continues to say, he says, it isn't so much, or it isn't only, that we're so makbid on that sophisticated discomfort, which we can barely understand what it is, but rather it's to develop a sensitivity. That if we are to become sensitive to the slightest discomfort felt even by an animal, halachas kama v'kama, how much more we feel for human pain. And I imagine from this, I always like to say, and it's not such good news, that it seems it's a Torah concept to make proper seating arrangements at a simcha. It's the same idea. If you put two people at the same table, they're not going to kill each other. They're not sworn enemies. But they're just not going to be, they don't know it, this one doesn't know, this one's shy, this one's this one has another friend, this one doesn't know anybody there. So you say, no, what can I do? But the Torah wanted a sensitivity to the feelings of another human being. And it ingrains and it sensitizes us to this sensitivity through the mitzvah of not plowing together. You're talking to a farmer. The farmer sits there and says, no, I can't put the ox with the donkey together. Why? Because I have to develop sensitivity. I don't even know if the animals really know that they feel. It's instinctive. It's intuitive. I don't know what it is, but it's for me. I can't allow myself to do such a thing because I have to develop sensitivity to the animals and extrapolate from that what it means to have human sensitivity. And the truth of the matter is, it's the same thing with the covering of the challah. First of all, what does it mean? What it means is as follows, that the halacha is that the brocha should really be made first on challah. That's the halacha, because that comes first. And wine should be after. For the covet of the sudas, For the COVID of the Suda Shabbos, the Chachomim instituted that we make Kiddush on wine. You know, when you take a kreis yayin and you make a brocha at the beginning of the meal, it's machshiv the whole thing. It's much more choshev. It's different from the whole week long. It gives it a certain distinction on yayin, which is the most choshev. Therefore, we take the wine ahead of the bread, which is the normal way. But so that the bread shouldn't be embarrassed that it's being degraded to a lower order, even though it should have been first, it's covered. The bread is going to be embarrassed. It shouldn't see us embarrassed. Obviously, it's not the bread, but it's us. If we learn to sensitize ourselves, even to things in the inanimate world, in other words, the bread doesn't feel any pain, but, you know, bread really should have been first. But we took wine because of the covered of the Suda Shabbos. Therefore, the bread has to be covered. So, to teach us a sensitivity. The farmer who's careful not to plow those two animals together, or the balabayis who's careful to cover the challah and sensitizes himself to that abstract, inanimate, non-feeling, but something wrong in the order of things, how much more so will he learn to be careful with human feelings? When somebody at the table spills something or something goes wrong a little bit, he's learned a lesson of human sensitivity. He's enhanced his sensitivity for people's feelings. And because of the extreme of the animals or the extreme of the challah, which is beyond human, the realm of human feeling, but he'll learn from that, he'll develop from that a sensitivity, how to deal with other people, how to deal better with his fellow man. And I think this is really what it's all about. I'd just like to close with one thought. It has to do with drinking. It has to do with Purim, actually. But it's not in favor. It's not against. It's just not in favor. But it tightens up what we're really all about and why we should crave this type of journey into better understanding the benefits that mitzvahs can give us and how they can make us happy. The Rambam at the end of Hilchas Purim has a shaila in halacha. He says, if a person did all the mitzvahs hayoyim, kesudas Purim, and matanas levyoyim, and shalachmonas, and he has some extra money, should he better do more shalachmonas or more suda? Suda has to do, of course, with drinking too. Or should he better do more matanas levyoyim? So Rambam says it's best to do more matanas levyoinim. Why? Because Purim is about simcha. The ikar of Purim is to have simcha. He says, Ein simcha ke simcha slave hamesameach umlolim bedalim ho'elu. He says, there is no happiness like the happiness of one who rejoices the heart of downtrodden and broken people. So if he gives matonas levyoinim and makes the oni who's tzibrochen, who's miserable, who doesn't have barely anything, uplifts him and makes him happy, there's no greater human simcha than the simcha of making an unfortunate, a less fortunate person, an unfortunate person happy. But he doesn't stop there. He says, why? Shehamesameach lev umlolim halolu doime l'shechina. Because one who rejoices the subrochana herza of these people, these broken-hearted people, he says, he is emulating the Shechina. He's emulating Hashem. And he brings a posuk, as it says, the posuk says that Hashem is lahachyis nefesh shvolim, or lahachyis lev nikoyim, that Hashem uplifts the downtrodden and uplifts the broken. And since he's emulating Hashem, he's connecting with Hashem, that's going to bring him the greatest simcha. So he says, if you want to achieve the real simcha, more simcha on Purim, then you should help these poor people, because that is the greatest source of simcha. And the reason is because it's spiritual. When we can, and it's very physical too, I mean, he's giving these people matonas levyoinim, he's helping them, he's giving away his money, he's giving away his food, he's giving to them. But the fact that in the process, I am emulating my Creator, I'm connecting with Hashem, I'm accessing some spiritual meaning and purpose and feeling in my life, that's the greatest sense of simcha. Because ultimately, when the horse and the rider, things come down to it, The horse is a behema, and the rider is the one. The rider's satisfaction is ultimately the key to happiness, to getting where we have to go, and to feeling good about it. And when we enhance our spiritual existence, when we connect with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and the way to most closely connect with him is by helping other people, by making other people feeling good. And so much of the Torah, Chazal say, Torah is tchilosek minos chasodim, esoyfet minos chasodim. So much is just to teach us minos chasodim that we should do for others and give to others. And ultimately, one who accesses and exercises all of the mitzvahs ha-Torah, which deal with making other people happy, finds himself to be the happiest of all people, because he's connected with his Creator, he's emulated his Creator, he's enhanced his spiritual life, and he finds true happiness. That's my story. It's not my story. It's a story that's thousands of years old, almost Shavuos. It's going to be 3,315 years since Maimon Har Sinai. Ashreinu.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.